Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The issues keep piling up. Gun control, abortion and contraception rights, LGBT rights, global climate change, immigration, healthcare reform, and you name the issue, there's a conflict. One, of course, filled with the voices of politicians, but often including the voices of many religious groups, all attesting to their devotion to the common good. Joining us now to talk about the roles of politicians and religion in the common good is Jim Wallace. He's president and CEO of the progressive evangelical group Sojourners, best-selling author, theologian, international commentator, and social activist. His new book is called On God's Side, What Religion Forgets and Politics Hasn't Learned About Serving the Common Good. Welcome to the show, Jim Wallace.
Great to be on. And let me ask, Little League baseball coach, we just finished our championship game on Saturday, and the 9-10-year-old team won.
Those are important things, right?
Oh, most important thing in my life.
Congratulations to your son.
Thank you.
We have to begin by defining the common good. You've quoted Catholic social teachings, which speak directly to the question, what do we mean by common good? I guess, is it different these days than it was in the past?
Well, you know, when we are only concerned about ourselves and our group and our tribe, our nation, our bubble, we're going to be in trouble pretty soon. When we begin to extend the notion of who my neighbor is, it was Rabbi Hillel who was asked once to stand on one foot and describe the essence of Jewish faith. He said, love thy neighbor as thyself. And the book talks about how that is foundational to all of our spiritual traditions, and it's really critical for the common good. We've lost in Washington, D.C., I'll just say, we've lost all notion of the common good. It's all about tribe, it's about party, it's about winning and losing, it's about my group and my money and my interests, and not about what's the best thing for all of us.
Isn't what's going on in Washington a reflection of what is happening out in the rest of the country?
No, it's worse. Washington, D.C. is the most dysfunctional city in the country. When I'm out in the country, I feel a hunger, a deep hunger for what we call the common good. I really feel it out there. But there's also this deep cynicism. So we did an 18-city book tour, and people would walk in, and they'd be bookstores, universities, churches, synagogues, and I could feel the hunger. And yet the cynicism was palpable. And it became almost a pastoral task to take an hour and try and move people from cynicism about Washington to believing they could do something again to change our public life. The opening line of the book says, our life together can be better. And most people, I think, want it to be. Washington, D.C. is an entirely dysfunctional city. Senators tell me here in town that they have to raise $20,000 on average every day to be reelected. 4 hours a day on the phone every day. Special interests control the city and destroy the common good. Let me just be as blunt as that. Around the country, I think people are really wanting to see us do what's best for all of us. But Washington, D.C. is totally polarized and paralyzed. I wrote this book on a sabbatical, first 3 months of the election year, and my discipline was not to speak to the political narrative or be interviewed by anybody or to write for those three months. But I watched the news cycle every night, and the more I watched and the more disengaged I was, the more depressing it seemed.
By the way, this is during the last general
election, the first 3 months of the election year. I think it's so vitriolic and so polarized and paralyzed. And the one exception is we may be about to pass bipartisan immigration reform. And I've talked to Republicans and Democrats in the White House, and they're almost giddy about doing something positive and something right for a change. And I think, but that's come from totally outside Washington.
I was going to say, I wanted to get to that. First, I want to remind people, they're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and my guest is Jim Wallace. We're talking about his new book, On God's Side, What Religion Forgets and Politics Hasn't Learned About Serving the Common Good. Yeah, the Gang of Eight and so forth, bipartisan, but so much of it's coming from other, it's coming from outside of Washington, it seems, in so much as Republicans need to attract more Latino Hispanic voters to their side.
Well, and you got that right. First of all, there was a real demographic shift in this last election, and the Republicans realize now that they're going to have no future if they are so harsh with the largest growing voting population in the country. The other thing, though, is we came to D.C. once with Bibles, badges in business. It was faith leaders, law enforcement leaders, and business leaders to say this immigration system is broken. It's breaking up families. It's not working for business. It's making law enforcement difficult. And we met with Republicans, Democrats, and they told us, you're going to have to, they almost said, you're going to have to hold our hand to help us to fix this thing. Pressure from the outside. The book talks about how all the change that we've seen, the big changes, have come from social movements outside of Washington. And the common good is what we build, the fabric of the quality of our life together, that creates social movements on abolition of slavery, women's suffrage, civil rights, and now immigration reform. And we're seeing people's lives change, their minds change. We're seeing people who are conservatives, liberals, all sides of the spectrum support fixing a broken system. And Washington, D.C. may be caught up in this social movement to fix that system, and for the first time in a long time may even do the right thing.
If you have a question or comment for Jim Wallace, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. You talked about how elected officials have forgotten about, particularly those in D.C., have forgotten about the common good. I recently interviewed former Ohio Congressman Bob Ney. He was the only elected official caught up in the Jack Abramoff scandal and sentenced to prison. And Bob Ney said that he intended to focus on the common good, but got lost along the way. We hear that story over and over again. What is it in the life of a politician that seems to get in the way? And you're saying it's 4 hours spent on the phone or whatever iteration of that is, gathering money and for reelection and apparently making promises?
Well, I know a lot of these folks in Congress and the Senate. And I'm not saying they're bad people. And some of them, I think most of them come here, and you're right, because they want to make a difference and be public servants. I think that's true. But after they're here, what they tell me is, I didn't realize the system was just so broken. Or I didn't understand, I heard this even in the White House, I didn't understand how much money controls everything here, everything. And so this system, the control of money over politics, is the last barrier to really achieving democracy in this country. We do not have a democracy. We have a plutocracy. And some interests and some powers that be are so much more influential than ordinary people. And so only social movements can really change money and power. And we have historically, and we will again. But finally, a new generation, I think, is going to take on this challenge. The book has a whole chapter on money and politics, how we have to break the control of money over politics. So I think they come here, and they tell me, you know, they've got to raise all this money with a very weary voice. They'd rather be reading the bills they're voting on. They'd rather be talking to other people than just donors. But the system is it's just corrupt. It's bought and sold. It's bought and sold. And take guns. I mean, take the gun question. 90% of the American people, including a majority of Democrats, majority of Republicans, and a majority of gun owners, favored common sense background checks for guns. 90% of us. And they failed. Because not even because the NRA is supported by their members. The NRA is supported by gun manufacturers. These are nothing but gun runners. Gun manufacturers control the Senate on gun legislation. That's money in politics.
It seems like despite your criticisms of the system, and a lot of people share your sentiment, that we're actually headed more in that direction. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled a few years ago in Citizens United, which gave corporations and groups the power to get involved in the political process without having to identify who they are. It seems to be going in the exact opposite direction of what you're suggesting.
You're right. The Supreme Court made one of the worst decisions in history, and that's talked about in the book at length. I'll just say it flat out here. What's at stake is democracy, nothing less. Democracy is at stake here. And Washington, D.C. Is effective, right? What they're effective in doing is maintaining the status quo. This whole system exists to protect special interests, not to protect the common good of the American people. I'll just say it as flat as I can. This system is utterly broken, and we're going to have to fix that. And it takes right now social movements, and immigration shows that we can still, you know, we can still change something if social movements on the outside. And this thing, the faith community has been just, I've never seen the faith community so game-changing on something politically. Ever since the Civil Rights Movement, pastors and lay people are saying, wait a minute, we see this broken system in our congregations, in our communities, and we got to change it. And so we're going to see a change, but only against the special interests that are here. So I think you're right. It's moving in the wrong direction. My hope in this book, though, is a movement for the common good is the very thing that could change, long-term, change the system.
My guest once again, Jim Wallace, public theologian, speaker, international commentator. We're talking about his newest book. It's called On God's Side, What Religion Forgets and Politics Hasn't Learned About Serving the Common Good. We'll get to some calls, and if you'd like to email us as well, allsides@wosu.org is the address. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Sherrington Group, financial planners and investment managers providing financial advice to client-focused solutions to help grow and preserve clients' wealth. The Sherrington Group, planning for success, managing for life, at sherringtongroup.com. This is WOSU 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Washington's new pledge to Syria, more military aid to the rebels. We'll look at what aid and what it may mean. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News.
Checking the weather forecast for Central Ohio, a slight chance of showers today, mostly cloudy otherwise. And then showers and thunderstorms possible tonight. The high today, 84 degrees. The low tonight, 66. By Tuesday, partly sunny and a high of 80. Currently, we have 76 degrees.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Jim Wallace. We are talking about his latest book. It's called On God's Side, What Religion Forgets and Politics Hasn't Learned About Serving the Common Good. Jim Wallace, a quote attributed to Abraham Lincoln inspired the title. Can you tell us how you arrived at that?
Well, Abraham Lincoln once famously said, "My concern is not whether God is on our side. My greatest concern is to be on God's side." That's my favorite presidential quote about religion, because religion and politics all tend to make the same mistake of bringing God onto our side. Saying God agrees with us and our side should win. Lincoln flipped the question. And Lincoln didn't always know what it meant to be on God's side, but he said that's the right question. And so it was a humility he brought to the conversation. And so I think that's what we have to ask here. To be on God's side, I think, means to find common ground for the common good. And what does the common good mean? We don't always know that either, but it's the right question. And so I'm having conservative and liberal people on both sides saying, this is the right debate to have. What is, in fact, the common good?
What about people who consider themselves agnostic, atheists? Are they part of the conversation, part of the tradition of common good in this country?
Absolutely. In fact, I really enjoy the at the end of these bookstore events, always somebody in the back will say, look, I'm an agnostic on good days, atheist on other days, but I was hoping I would feel a part of the conversation tonight, and I really did. The common good is in all of our religious traditions. It really is. Judaism, Islam, you know, the Gospels. But also, it's in our democratic, secular traditions, the golden rule, treating others the way you want to be treated. So this common good conversation is really for all of us, religious or not. And we've had some great conversations all across the country, across the entire spectrum of people who believe very different things. But the common good brings us together here. And again, it's almost a pastoral, it felt almost pastoral with all these people from different backgrounds, making them believe again that their personal commitments, what we choose to do in our lives, our families, our congregations, our neighborhoods, our communities, what those choices are, that's what builds the common good. And the cynicism, you know, skepticism is a good thing, healthy, tough questions, particularly of Washington or Wall Street. But cynicism is spiritually dangerous because it really is a buffer against personal commitment. And the only thing that makes change is personal commitment. And so what I want to say to people in this book and around the country as we're talking is believe that your personal choices and commitments, everything from the way you raise your kids to how you interact in your neighborhood, how you connect with your public officials, what really breaks your heart? What offends your sense of justice most? Joining with others around those things, that can change the world. I really think we can change the world, but not by depending on Washington.
Richard in Westgate, you're on the air. Welcome, Richard.
Hi. I'm an evangelical Christian, but I have to confess I find myself very much at odds with Jim Wallis on a whole range of issues. And we've been working with trying to dialogue with his buddy out there in Westerville, Rich Nathan, about abortion. And there is an abortion clinic about a mile from his church, and they just kill thousands of these babies every year.
You know what, Richard, let's make sure that you get your facts straight on that. But let's just get to your question right off the bat.
Am I still on?
You're still on, but tell us what your question is for Jim Wallis.
Well, I want to know, how does he square up a Christian worldview with abortion and what his phrase is, the least of these, and just who are the least of these and who are our neighbors?
Okay.
And by the way, we live in a republic, not a democracy. And is Eric Holder one of the gun runners he's talking about?
Jim Wallis?
On the abortion question, mm-hmm. He's talking about Rich Nathan, the pastor of the Vineyard Church in Columbus, Ohio. He's a dear friend of mine. And what Rich is pro-life, and what they do is they, every year, there are hundreds of women, pregnant women, that they bring into their circle of support to help them take their child to term. It's trying to support women who are often a very vulnerable place, often a very lonely place, and if they want to carry their child to term, they help them do that. That's extremely pro-life. I love that way that Rich and his team are doing that. So I work with people around the country, and I think the pro-life and pro-choice sides in this debate should come together to try and practically, concretely reduce the number of abortions in this country. I think both sides could come together and do that. So I'm trying to find common ground for the common good. And reducing abortion, for me, is one of the important issues.
Okay, Richard, thank you so much for your call. Cody in Clintonville, you're on the air with Jim Wallace. Welcome, Cody.
Hi. I was just wondering, with kind of the cultural, that we see this evolution of acceptance towards gay marriage, and particularly in seeing certain denominations accept it, do you think that will be something that people will view as part of the common good eventually and could pass with bipartisan support?
Well, I think the issue here is civil marriage, and I've always been in favor of equal protection under the law for gay and lesbian people. And so for a long time, I probably felt like civil unions would accomplish that, but more and more younger people have convinced me that that equal protection means civil marriage for gay people as well, for marriage equality. Now, I think religious communities have got to be protected in religious liberty to work out this issue for themselves, theologically, biblically, and so on. That's important. But I think a lot of young people have been leaving the churches because of how they perceive churches treating gay people. And I think, churches can wrestle with this issue, and they should biblically. That's what I do as an evangelical. But I think I'm not sure churches want to stand on the side of opposing civil protection, civil marriage for gay people. I think that's contributes to this notion of how churches are mistreating gay and lesbian people. So marriage equality can be something that people come together around as a civil right, even if they still wrestle with different views over time on the theology of all of this or whatever. But I think a new generation is going to resolve this. And 50 years from now, a new generation is going to resolve this question. In the meantime, how we talk to each other, how we treat each other, how we show respect to each other is going to be very important.
Cody, thanks a lot for your question. So 50 years from now, it'll be resolved. And if it's headed in the same, if it ends up where it's headed, that means that there will be, marriage will be legal for everybody. Is that, if that occurs, do you see that as a part of the common good? Do you think we'll be a better country for it?
Well, the heart of the common good for me is people ask me, are you for marriage equality? I say, well, first of all, I'm for marriage. We're losing marriage in this country. We're really losing marriage in low-income neighborhoods especially, but across the classes, we're losing marriage. Mm-hmm. And how do we recommit, recovenant to monogamy, to fidelity, to parenting? That's, to me, the key issue here. And I'd like that to be our common ground for the common good. I like to see liberals and conservatives come together and say, marriage is the issue here. How do we restore, reestablish, recovenant to marriage? Because without marriage, we're in serious trouble. Healthy marriage, healthy parenting, focusing on raising our children, that is essential for the common good. So that's the first question. And the second question is, should same-sex couples be included in that benefit? I'm saying yes. People can disagree with that. But there ought to be a commitment to marriage first of all. And I think that's essential to the common good.
Cody, thanks a lot for your call. We appreciate it. I interviewed a researcher last week about the plight of inner-city fathers. One of the concepts that came out of that discussion, Jim Wallace, was the idea that those men, young and old, 16 to 40, have so idealized the idea of marriage that they are putting it off for later when they can find that perfect partner whom they can perfectly trust. And meanwhile, they go on to have children. The two are not connected. And I thought the idealization of marriage was a really interesting concept that came out of that conversation.
Well, we have to look at all the obstacles here. And one of them is, for a lot of, there's an awful lot of incarceration of young men of color in poor neighborhoods. And that kind of massive incarceration is really an anti-marriage obstacle. So is not finding paying jobs, living wages, family wages for work. So how do we find, how do we talk about the kind of jobs that can support families and marriages? And how do we recommit to a commitment culture? We're in a culture that really is taking us away from making commitments And so how do we recommit to a commitment-focused culture? And to me, you know, the notion of two people making a commitment and raising kids, that's an ideal, that's a necessary ideal for the common good. But I've been in neighborhoods, Ann, where most of the kids in a poor neighborhood where I've lived have never even been to a wedding in their lives.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Not once, never been. Or never been to a home where there are two parents. Now, how do you do something you've never seen? So we have a serious marriage problem, and all the arguments about gay marriage, I sometimes miss the basic problem we have is losing marriage. How do we reestablish marriage, first of all, and then decide whether same-sex couples can be a part of the benefit of that? I'm saying yes, others can disagree, but let's get the marriage commitment down, and then I want to make it inclusive.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Jim Wallace. We're talking about his latest book. It's called On God's Side, What Religion Forgets and Politics Hasn't Learned About Serving the Common Good. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from Evan in Toledo. He asks, what are Jim's thoughts on how the primary system during the elections has polarized our representatives and senators?
Good question. Let's take that in two parts. First of all, this last election year showed that literally one or two donors can make a primary candidate viable. One or two billionaires can decide who the candidates are going to be. This is not a democratic system. Secondly, I would say Washington, D.C. and our political system is really funded by extreme elites on both sides. It's funded by extreme wealthy elites. So,
what do you mean by elite?
I mean, very wealthy people decide who's going to run because it costs so much money to run. And the money is on both sides. There's conservative money and liberal money on both sides. And they decide who's going to run. And so they're always afraid in D.C. of being primaried. You hear them say that. I'm afraid if I take this stance, I'll be primaried,
mm-hmm.
meaning somebody who is to the right or to the left of them is going to run against them in a primary. And they're going to be funded by wealthy elites. So the system is really funded by wealthy elites. Some are liberal, some are conservative, but they're funded by moneyed people on both sides. And so I think that tends to make our politics more extreme, and the lonely voices are those who are trying to be more moderate or find common sense solutions to our problems. And as a person of faith, I always like to remind people that left and right are not religious categories; they're political ones. And when people of faith try and squeeze their religion into those political categories, left and right, it distorts our faith. And I think the faith community should do two things: offer a prophetic voice, or often a truthful voice, or particularly on behalf of the poor and vulnerable. One of your callers talked about the least of these. That's Matthew 25th chapter, when Jesus says, how we treat the least of these. I was hungry, I was thirsty, I was a stranger, I was naked, I was in prison, I was sick. Jesus says, and you weren't there for me. The least of these, he said, that's how you treat me. And the reason so many Christians are moving on the immigration question, they'll tell you, is because they realize that when Jesus says, the way you treat the stranger is the way you treat me, they're realizing that's now 11 million undocumented people who are strangers. And the way we treat them is the way we treat Christ himself. And that's converted many evangelicals to this question. So that's our role, to defend the poorest and most vulnerable. And I think then to bring people together, like we are in immigration, left and right, to do the right thing.
Jim Wallace, in general, do all religions assume a similar common good?
Well, sometimes our religious practice isn't the same as the things we say we believe. All of our traditions say that how we treat the poorest and most vulnerable is very central. The prophets all say that. They say that a society is judged not by its gross national product or its military firepower or its popular culture being the envy of the world. A society is judged by how it treats the most vulnerable. That's what the Bible says. Now, often, though, people don't see us as religious people doing that. When we actually do the things that our faith says we should do, when Christians do what Jesus said and did, two things happen. It surprises people, and then it attracts people. And so what the book is saying is if we just start walking the talk, if we just start doing what we say, practicing what we preach, it could turn things around. Everyone knows, I think, you know, what Jesus was saying. But to find churches doing that is often much more difficult. So we have a credibility issue here, but I think particularly a new younger generation, I talk to young people all the time. Half my staff is under 30, and I'm very encouraged by this new generation. The book is really written in part to them because they want their faith and their lives to make a difference in the world. And when that happens, it attracts other people to faith.
What is your sense about why the younger generation that you, why they're feeling that way versus I want my piece of the pie too? What triggered this generalized wanting to do good and do right by each other?
Well, I think to start with, our neighbor now is this gospel question. Who is my neighbor? In fact, it was a lawyer that asked Jesus that question, who is my neighbor? And what people don't realize in the Gospels, it was a Washington lawyer who asked him that question. Because I recognize that tone of voice. You know, it wasn't, who is my neighbor? How can I help? It was, all right, just who is my neighbor? How can I avoid responsibility here?
Technically.
Yeah. So I was in a conference here in town about the Congo and about the minerals in the Congo that are all used to make our cell phones, right? Mm-hmm. But the profits from the minerals are going to warlords who are buying weapons and pillaging innocent people, particularly women and children. Here's a big conference in D.C. trying to figure out what to do about the dirty minerals. So I read this Good Samaritan story, the story of the lawyer and Jesus, and then Jesus named this Good Samaritan, this one who man falls off his horse, he's robbed, he's beat, he's hurt, and the religious leaders pass him by, they walk by, and somebody comes up who's from a different race, different region, different part of the world, and he helps the person. And Jesus says, that's what I mean by helping your neighbor. Now, so I said to these people, I said, okay, that means to me, whoever helps make our cell phones, whose lives are impacted by our cell phones, I said, hold them up. They all held them up. This is your significant other. I said, you spend more time with this cell phone than most people in the world every day. Whoever helped you make that cell phone is your neighbor. So how do we turn supply chains into value chains? During the book tour, we had a factory collapse in Bangladesh. You know, so many people killed, making the clothes on our backs. A younger people, I think, feel connected more around the world. They're more globalized. They think more. I've got a 14-year-old and a 10-year-old. And it's amazing to me how they, you know, they just go online and they, you know, they think globally now. They're traveling more. And they see their neighbor as more than just who's just like me or in my group or right next door. And so I think that broader sense of who our neighbor is, I've got a chapter in the book called The Good Samaritan Goes Global. What does it mean to think of our neighbors in that global sense? I see that something very positive in this new generation.
My guest is Jim Wallace, theologian, speaker, and author of many books, his latest, On God's Side, What Religion Forgets and Politics Hasn't Learned About Serving the Common Good. If you have a question or comment for Jim Wallace, you are welcome to join the conversation. 614-292-8513 is the number. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, an untold story from World War II. Thousands of American soldiers deserted the front lines. Journalist Charles Glass says most served bravely in combat before leaving their units.
Those soldiers who fought continuously and were never rotated out of the front lines simply were under so much pressure for so long that they cracked.
Glass's book is The Deserters. Join us.
Fresh Air comes your way starting at 12 noon today right here at 89.7 NPR News.
Business news. It's not all banks, budgets, and bottom lines, you know. At Marketplace, we think it can be lots of things, like...
So, maybe you've heard of the Kardashians.
iPhone and iPad app.
Christian Dior.
Wine.
We Fit.
Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
The NFL.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Whether you need news or the numbers or just a good laugh, join us next time for Marketplace, the business show for the rest of us. It's from APM, American Public Media.
Weekday afternoons at 6 on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Varmint Guard Environmental Services, the company with the gold-lettered black trucks. Varmint Guard has served Central Ohio for 30 years, helping to treat and prevent pest and wildlife problems. More information at 614-794-8169 or varmintguard.com.
Currently 76 degrees in Central Ohio, on our way to a high of 84. Chance of showers and thunderstorms later today and tonight. An overnight low of 66 degrees on Tuesday. Chance of rain once again and a high of 80.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Jim Wallace. We're talking about his new book. It's called On God's Side, What Religion Forgets and Politics Hasn't Learned About Serving the Common Good. If you have a question or comment, please join us, 614-292-8513. Jim Wallace, if I were to ask how Speaker John Boehner or Senator Marco Rubio or Senator Sherrod Brown from Ohio or any number of lawmakers and politicians, they would say they work for the common good, wouldn't they? It seems like only people like, say, a Bob Ney or that kind of a person who's been humiliated for their wrongdoing comes out and says, I was wrong, and it's the system that's wrong. It's very rare that you find people in power who are willing to admit that there's a problem with the attainment of that power.
Well, you know, I know a lot of these people, and in personal conversations, they often do share their frustration about how it seems so limited in D.C. what they can do. And I don't think there really is much talk about the common good. And I think if that language were reintroduced, I'm not saying I have all the answers to what the common good is, but I think it's the right question. And when we're putting it beyond just our own group, our party, our interest, I mean, literally on immigration, I had Republicans and Democrats in the Senate say to me in meetings, Jim, normally we would treat this issue in a way that would help us win the next election. We're just being honest here. But on this issue, we're promising you and the faith community that we won't do that. The system is really broken. We agree with you. We want to protect those 11 million undocumented people you've been talking about so much. And we're promising you on this one, we're going to do whatever is necessary to produce a bipartisan bill that will pass. And the Senate is likely now to pass that by the end of June, by the July 4th recess. And I'll tell you, having been deeply involved in the whole process, the Judiciary Committee amendment process, I saw Republicans and Democrats putting aside their group interests and special interests and what they normally do to protect a bipartisan bill. And that is really unusual in this town.
It reminds me of when I was covering the General Assembly in Ohio some years ago, many years ago. They had a rule that if your bill cost money, you had to show how you were going to pay for it. What if, I guess, is that kind of larger question, lawmakers and so forth at the state and the federal level had to first show how it addressed the common good?
Well, I think that'd be a great question to ask.
Well, it's kind of idealistic, but it just they don't do that anymore, by the way, with the money spending. Nick in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. Hi, Nick.
Hey,
yep.
Hey, Jim, quick question. So
Nick, Nick, time out. We're getting a really terrible echo. Do you have your phone? Do you have your radio on somewhere or?
Just turn the radio off.
Good. Sounds like it. Good. Welcome to the show, Nick.
Great. Thank you so much. Just a quick question for Jim. My girlfriend and I are driving across the country back to seminary. We're both in our mid-20s. I'm sorry?
Yep. You're here.
Okay. And we were wondering if the role of service learning in universities and the more young people participating in programs like that isn't somehow contributing to this broader global consciousness you've been talking about, more attention to the common good, and if a similar sort of move towards service in seminaries wouldn't be a good thing. I'd be interested to hear your thoughts.
Well, that's a very good point. I think you're exactly right, Nick. I think the young people that who I teach in my classes or that I meet on the road, their resumes have so much service on them, more than is necessary for a balanced resume. I mean, they're really volunteering. My own son, my 14-year-old, after school, he gets on the subway and goes down to a really tough inner-city school, and he's a baseball player, so he uses baseball to do literacy for these young kids in the second grade. And, you know, he loves it. And you know, that kind of experience changes people's lives. I go to Christian colleges around the country, and, you know, more than half the students are volunteering. And what that does, it puts them in relationship to people who are outside of their bubbles and their neighborhoods and their schools and their worlds, and it changes their thinking. It takes away stereotypes. It puts them in touch with real people, and they can see, you know, what's behind our education problems or homelessness or joblessness. They get to meet the families and the people and the kids, and their heart goes out to them. So the beginning, I think, of understanding what has to change is proximity, you know, to be in relationship with people who are poor and vulnerable. That changes our minds and our hearts, and that opens us up then to the movements that really make not just service, but then justice also possible. So that's key. And seminaries, I think, you're right, are doing this more and more and more. Let's get out of the house more often, get out of our small worlds, and go to places. I mean, I have to say that I've learned most about the world by being in places I wasn't supposed to be.
Thank you, Nick, for that call. Once again, we have a few more minutes left with Jim Wallace. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. So, Jim, what about the common good and the idea of pursuit of happiness, which for many is, in essence, self-interest? That's one of the foundations of our way of life in this country.
You know, I I'll go back to my little league here. you know, I live right next door to the baseball field, right? We moved here on purpose, and all the kids came by last night for the big. We won the championship, and we're undefeated 9-10-year-old kids. And the way they talked at the end was about how much every player contributed, every single player, and how they became such close friends and good friends. And one kid said at the end, he says, you know, if any of us had been different, I don't think we would have won this game. And the game was not just the best kids doing well. It was kids just stepping up, and some of the weakest kids came forward and made great plays, and you could see their tremendous sort of love for each other, and all the parents are standing around listening to all this. And I'll tell you, those parents would say, the best thing for my kid was to be on this team and learn how to be teammates and learn how to take care of each other and look out for each other. And when we make mistakes, there's no negative talk. It's get them next time. And so, I mean, practically, as a parent, I want to say, what makes me happy is when my kids, learn what it means to be good teammates, as you will. We're a baseball family here. But be good teammates is part of the common good. And on that baseball field, carpooling becomes life pooling. And cancer diagnosis gets shared with hugs, your baseball families and your church families. And I think we are going to be a lot happier if we're more connected to each other than just on our own and just looking after ourselves. That finally doesn't really make us and our kids happy in the end.
You know, youth sports is a great analogy for a lot of things, including some of the most negative things in our society. You have a great example of a team that pulled together lots of different kinds of kids. They won the championship. A lot of us know about different kinds of teams where only certain kids get to play because winning's everything.
Well, I talk a lot in the book about, Father's Day was yesterday, about fatherhood, parenting, about coaching. A lot of my coaching stories are in the book. And you're exactly right. But, we can I've got three rules. One, we're going to have fun. Number two, we're going to be good teammates. No negative talk is ever allowed by parents, by coaches, by kids. And three, we're going to learn to love the game of baseball. And one of my favorite plays Saturday was one of the weakest kids on the team. He was at the start. He just doesn't know how to play baseball at all. He went after a line drive hit down the first base line. He was in right field. He snagged that ball and he threw it to second base. And the kid thought he'd double. He had to run back to first. And this kid was so proud of himself because he'd come so far. And he was out there playing. And he plays. My kids play in the infield, not just the outfield. We all get to play, and they look after each other. And not only were they undefeated, but then they won the championship, but they had fun. They had fun, and they really enjoyed each other's teammates. And I don't think, and I know coaches, it's just play to win all the time. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that works with kids. I don't think it works. And so I have a lot in the book about what it means to coach in this way for the common good. And it's youth sports are archetypal of our lives. And I love to see a community come together with parents, which they did this weekend, and to see that this thing was good for all of us, for kids, for parents, for the community. And I think it can be done in a very different kind of way when it's not taking the ethic of the society, which is that winning is everything. Washington, D.C., winning is everything. Governing has been lost. How do we really take care of the common good in Little League baseball and in the halls of Congress in Washington, D.C.? That's really our question. And I think we can do that by making the epilogue of this book is 10 personal decisions you can make. All of us can make in our families, our lives, our workplaces, our faith places. We can make these decisions for the common good. If we don't, and we just fall back into cynicism, I think we're in trouble.
Tina, you are on the air with Jim Wallace. Welcome to the show, Tina.
Hi, thank you so much. I appreciate it. My concern is the pastors of the churches. I don't understand how any person can proclaim to be a child of God if they encourage gay marriage or fornication or shacking up. That's just not Christ-like.
Okay.
Well, as I said before in this conversation, we have to return to fidelity and to monogamy and to parenting. And I think the promiscuous culture, the non-committal culture, the treating women as commodities and sexual objects, that's all over our culture. That is contrary to the common good and the way of Christ. Now, how do we treat with compassion our gay brothers and sisters and same-sex couples who are trying to figure this out for themselves, and should they have the protections, equal protection under the law? I think that they should. The first issue, though, is how do we restore marriage, and then I think protect equally under the law of people who are from same-sex couples. So that's a controversial question. I'm happy to talk about it biblically and theologically, and the faith community has to have time and space to do that. But the first question is, how do we recommit ourselves to marriage? And that, I think, is foundational to the common good.
All right, Tina, thanks a lot for your call. Harrison in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Harrison.
Thanks. I just want to start by saying thank you and for acknowledging the agnostic and atheist community as valid in this discussion and a part of the dialogue in these matters.
Okay.
And second, you're talking about the system being more or less totally broken. I wondered what you would think about the formation of like a reform party, the likelihood of that, or how that would go about.
Okay. So any hope for a third party? It's been tried before, Jim Wallace. What about around the concept of common good?
Right. First of all, as a person of faith, I want to always say what I think the faith should be doing. But religion has no monopoly on morality. There are people who are deeply moral in their sensibilities who are not people of faith, and I know many of them. I work with them all the time. So we can work across the boundaries here. Third parties don't really, in this country, it's not a parliamentary system. So third parties don't succeed long term. But what does succeed is movements. So third way movements, I think social movements, can work. Like, I think we have a movement now to make immigration reform possible, led really by the faith community. But we had sort of civil rights movements. I think we're going to have a movement around money and politics. There is a growing movement that we're a part of about women and girls, empowering women and girls to overcome poverty globally, all around the world. That's making a difference. There's a movement around environmental stewardship, taking care of the planet that God created, concerns about climate change. These are concerns that young people really share, especially. So not a third party, I don't think, but a third way is important, and social movements that push both parties to move toward the common good.
Harrison? There. Okay. Thank you, Harrison, for your call. We're just about out of time. When you took your sabbatical, Jim Wallace, a few years ago, were you planning on writing a book?
Well, I was planning on writing, but I wasn't, sure exactly what I wanted to write. And every morning I'd get up and very early and have some nice quiet time and space, and then I'd exercise, and then I would read and write all day. And at night I'd watch the news cycle, and watching it and as I was disengaged from it was really discouraging. And I began to see we'd lost this very ancient idea called the common good. And I think it's in all our traditions, religious and secular, and it can, I think, bring us back. And so as I've been out on the road now talking about the book and the common good, I really feel the hunger out there. And I want to say to people, don't fall into the cynicism, which I think makes us withdraw from commitment. But the book talks about what you can do, and the epilogue is 10 practical things people can do to change their lives, their neighborhoods, their congregations, their communities, their families, starting out with your own family, and how that can build social movements that really make the common good possible. So we can do this, but it means going back to making the kind of personal decisions that really are going to make a difference long term, and that really is still very possible, and that will change the common good.
Jim Wallace, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Great to be on your show, Ann.
Jim Wallace, he's the author of On God's Side, What Religion Forgets and Politics Hasn't Learned About Serving the Common Good. You know what? You can listen to All Sides with Ann Fisher weekdays from 10 a.m. to noon for a show focused on these issues. You can learn more about the show and the guests by liking us on Facebook and following WOSU All Sides on Twitter. Thanks so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org.